This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
I like my fiction to be diverse. So in a book like Astray, I really like alternating the points of view of men and women and the rich and the poor and, you know, just getting a sense of that mixture of populations that has come to America and Canada and made them the, you know, wonderful mixed up places they are today.
If you're removing the answer from the question and just saying all writing is political, do you think that's true?
I do. I don't mean that all writing has a clear political agenda, because, you know, if we wanted to write a campaign, we would. It would be a lot simpler. But I think you're making decisions as soon as you choose to write a short story about somebody. You know, even a two-page short story, you're already making decisions, not just about how to represent them, but about whose point of view to give at all. It's very aware that historical fiction, like the kind I write, is mostly a matter of giving voices back to those who've been forgotten, you know, hit losers often, or giving a new angle on things, something that hasn't been said before, revisiting older issues. Both that and my contemporary fiction, I'm just very aware that the kind of choices you make always have a politics behind them.
What do you think draws you to people who are unrepresented?
You know, I grew up on stories of royalty. You know, I used to read historical novels about people like Henry VIII all the time, you know, and there's still a thrill to that. I mean, you know, I'm immersed in the second of Hilary Mantel's Thomas Cromwell novels at the moment. It's absolutely fascinating. But to me, it's even more exciting to come across a case of somebody who's completely dropped out of the historical record, or somebody who mattered once and has since been forgotten about. You just have more of a sense of the power of fiction if you manage to bring someone like that to life in your writing.
Emma Donoghue, you've started work on another novel, which you say is kind of a crime novel. That's the one set in San Francisco in the 1870s?
That's right, yes. There's a particular murder that happened on the south side of San Francisco.
Real one?
Yes, an unsolved murder where a young woman was shot through a window. I've been preoccupied with this case for at least 10 years. The sources are mostly newspaper accounts of the inquest, and they're all clashing and inconsistent, and it's the kind of muddy, messy source that's just perfect for fiction.
You've been listening to an interview with Emma Donoghue, whose latest book is Astray, a collection of short stories, and her novel Room is just out in paperback. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. For more information about this show, go to bookwaves.com, where you'll also find an extended version of this interview. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today I'm live in the studio with two celebrated local comics artists whose work got its start on the web. But they've now both got big hardcover graphic novels on the bookshelves. Barry Deutsch and Jen Manley Lee, welcome back to KBOO.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, I'm delighted to have both of you in the studio today because you've supported each other. You're local Portland talents who've supported each other in all sorts of projects. Jen, you are the creator of Dicebox, which is a huge sprawling work, but you also designed the color palette for Barry's book, Hereville, and the second Hereville is on the shelves now.
Yeah, well, I would more call myself a color consultant. I react to the colors and I make suggestions. I give a starting point, but I would say Barry and Jake finish it off nicely.
And the two of you have been mainstays of the comics artists at the Portland Opera events.
Yes.
That was actually when it started out here a couple of years ago. That was a unique event, but now actually it seems like number of opera companies have invited comics artists to do interpretations of some of their works.
Cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah, San Diego Opera was one of them. I don't know if it lasted, though. It's still going strong here in Portland.
Well, you know, other cities try to do Portland. They try to have food carts. They try to support their cartoonists. But can they really manage it? No. Except probably Brooklyn.
Well, let's talk about the two works here. Now on the shelves is the second volume of Hereville, and this is How Mirka Met a Meteorite. This is Barry's book, and it follows up the first one, How Mirka Got Her Sword. This is, okay, tell me about this. This is a Orthodox Jewish community that's sort of maybe set in the Northwest in contemporary times. Not something that a lot of people would stumble across, but you somehow make it work. Tell us about the story.
Okay, well, for both Hereville books, it's about an 11-year-old Orthodox Jewish girl who wants to fight monsters. This book is about sort of her dreams of what she'd like to be. She's always had this image of eventually becoming this monster-fighting hero who can beat anyone with a sword and, you know, doesn't have to listen to what anyone says. And in this, this is one of those traditional magical twin stories where she meets a magical twin who is everything that she dreams of being, is super strong and can beat 1,000 monsters easily and so on. And hopefully, you know, it's what she has to deal with when she realizes that she's met her ideal self and she doesn't really like it that much.
Yeah, it's sort of, not too many spoilers here, but it kind of reminds me of the movie Weird Science, where the boys have this adolescent view of what they really, you know, what they really want, and it turns out that when they get their wish, it's something different that they really need.
Well, that's a comparison I've never once thought of in my life, but yes, I can see what you mean.
So originally, the second book was going to be all about Mirka's sister getting married. That sort of moved around. So you're going to continue the series and have more adventures of Mirka.
Right. It was decided to move that storyline for when Mirka's older than 11,
okay.
Since some of the problems she faces there are a little bit more mature. So right now I'm working on the third book, which is going to be a further development of the careful what you wish for theme, I guess, and is also going to be the last book where she's 11 years old. Starting with the fourth book, we're going to begin aging her up.
Now, I remember in the first book, there were a number of characters. You have a great number of characters, family and community, and actually last time you were on the show, we talked about an author and academic, Stephanie Levine, who complimented you on the accuracy of the Orthodox Jewish culture that you portrayed in Hereville, the details about the family and community. And you mentioned Professor Levine's book, Mystics, Mavericks, and Merrymakers, An Intimate Journey Among Hasidic Girls. During Levine's research, she was struck by, you know, how strong and forthright and outgoing Hasidic teenage girls were, in contrast to the teenage girls from mainstream culture. So this is something that you sort of took and you turned it into a real adventure. What I'm kind of interested in is because you're a guy doing doing very, very, very deep work about a lot of female characters, I'm actually going to put you on the spot and I'm going to ask Jen how well Barry does at portraying adolescent girls. Because, you know, it's tricky. Only a few authors. Linda Barry is one of my comics artists that I think that I believe does really great work portraying adolescent boys. But what do you think?
I'll have firsthand experience in about 7 years, but I would say he does pretty well. I like the logic. I like the single-mindedness. I think he does great because he takes the old adage of don't think girl, think person. And Mirka is a great 11-year-old person. And I the Rochelle, which is closer to my daughter's age, is another good person.
That's right. You're a mom of a preschooler?
Yes, 4 years old and crazy as heck.
Okay. And actually, Rochelle is another character that we think is kind of flighty in the first book and turns out to be really wise. There's a lot of transformation among the characters in the second Hereville book.
Well, in the first book, she's really much more of a supporting of a minor character. We see her, but we only see her from a more distant view. The way I think of these books is because Mirka has so many siblings. Each book, a different sibling gets to be the primary sidekick. So in the first book, her brother Zindel was the primary sidekick. In the second book, her sister Rochelle is the primary sidekick. In the third book, her five-year-old little sister Lael, who only appears on page one of the second book, is going to be the sidekick. and we'll get to know Lael. So gradually, I'm going to get to a lot of her family this way.
Now, I'm going to tell you, some of the things that drive me crazy about your books, Barry, is that I love them. They're very smooth reads, and they're great for all ages. But you keep setting up stuff that is going to be resolved later, and like in this book, in the second book, there's a witch character who lives in the woods, and she's a really compelling character, and she's almost like a counterpart to Mirka's stepmother, Fruma. But we keep seeing really enticing things about both characters, about Fruma and about the witch. There seems to be some sort of connection with them somewhere, and it's still not resolved. And then one of these days, I'm hoping you're gonna give us more information.
I'm going to give you more in book three. We're definitely going to get more of Fruma's backstory in book three, including a little bit of Fruma's backstory with the witch, just a little. But I'm hopefully going to keep readers frustrated for a while to come. The entire thing of what's going on with Fruma and the witch is something that is going to be dribbled out throughout the series, and I don't want to give people too much too soon.
Okay. Well, since we last talked, your first book, Hirville, How Mirka Got Her Sword, has been nominated for an Eisner Award, a Harvey Award, an Ignatz Award, the Andre Norton Award, and it's the only graphic novel ever to win the Sidney Taylor Book Award. So I guess congratulations are in order.
Thank you.
And, you know, this reminds me, thinking about Will Eisner, who was one of the great early comics talents. Well, I guess it could be argued that comics and, you know, Scott McCloud is an associate of both of you and has actually complimented both of you. Dicebox, Jen's comic, has been listed as one of the great web comics by Scott McCloud. But it could be argued certainly that comics go back to the early days of the printing press or even further, as anybody who's seen, you know, iconography, orthodox iconography around the world can say. But the phenomenon that we think of as comics is largely an invention of Jewish Americans from Eastern Europe back in our grandparents' and great-grandparents' day.
Woohoo! In your face, Goyim.
Whatever, I'm a Jersey girl, I count.
And you know, Michael Chabon's book, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, is a fictionalized version of what went on a lot during the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah, and I love that book, but I had a basic doctrinal disagreement with it, which is that if you read that, it's very clear that Chabon, is that how you pronounce it?
It could be Chabon or Chabon, I'm not sure.
Would think of Jack Kirby as being the greatest cartoonist of that age, and I would think of Eisner as being the greatest cartoonist of that age. So I was reading it going, well, yes, but this guy is second place, since the main cartoonist character in the novel is a stand-in for Jack Kirby.
Sure. Eisner did some really great fictionalized historical depictions of the New York neighborhoods that were immigrant neighborhoods, Jewish neighborhoods, brownstones, and walk-ups from the 20s, 30s. So he's certainly celebrated for that. That came sort of later in his career. I think early on, a lot of the comics artists were really trying to kind of fit in, sort of the way Irving Berlin was writing White Christmas, you know, back in the 20s and 30s.
Oh, yeah, you couldn't. There were no openly Jewish characters back then, although a lot of the characters seem Jewish, you know, when you look at them later. There's the whole argument for why Superman is Jewish, that, you know, Superman is this immigrant who has to disguise himself as being one of the regular goyim around him. But, you know, when he strips off the disguise and lets his home colors fly, that's when he's really spectacular.
Well, he's the golem, right? Or that's at least what Chabon has as an idea. Puts forward as an idea. Well, speaking of which, you are featured in a collection, an anthology that Harvey Pekar and Paul Bewley edited called Yiddishkeit, Jewish Vernacular and the New Land. You did a four-pager about Zero Mostel.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. They asked me to if I could contribute to it. And at first my first suggestion was a woman whose name I'm blanking on from the Yiddish theater, and they said...
Oh, Sophie Tucker, or no?
No, earlier than that, okay. Who was famous for doing a lot of cross-dressing roles.
Oh, okay.
And They said, no, you need to pick someone that anyone's heard of, and gave me a list. And I was like, oh, Zero Mostel. I love Zero Mostel. And it ended up being a great experiment in trying to be concise, because how do you pack an entire man's life into just 4 pages? And hopefully people will enjoy it. I've gotten some nice reactions to that story.
Well, speaking of which, gender play is kind of a thing that happens in both your books and both your stories. Let's cross over a little bit. I want to get back to some of the work that you've done, including some stuff for Bitch Magazine, which is a locally published magazine. You did a story called How to Make a Man Out of Tinfoil. And you're also, actually, you're working on, there's a feminist anthology that you're going to be in, right?
Right. Actually, that story is going to be in the feminist anthology, which is called The Big Feminist Butt.
B-U-T, with one T, yes.
Yes, and easy to Google, though. And it's an anthology of feminist stories, and I did a story all about a little boy. In fact, I don't think any girls appear in that story at all. And I was very grateful that they kind of saw where I was going with it. It's a story all about how sexism and sexist role expectations impact some boys.
Oh, yeah.
And they were very happy to print it. And it was one of 3 stories they chose to feature on Bitch Magazine's website. So I was very happy with that.
Well, it's a very interesting, yeah, the dynamics of how some people in authority are very cowardly and don't step up when they should. Is one of the themes of this. In the upcoming, and this, I guess there's a Kickstarter going on right now for The Big Feminist Butt, and so people can look that up online. And Sarah Oleksik, friend of the show, is part of this as well. Tom Neely, Jen Wang, Jeffrey Brown, Shannon Garrity. So some great comics people in it. So gender. Let's talk about Dicebox, because this is has become a really popular, beautiful comic online, and now there is a hardback version. It's a big, full color volume, and this one, there's going to be 4 volumes of Dicebox. Is that correct, Jen?
That's correct.
So the first one is called Wander.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. And to describe Wander, you would just talk, it's a couple of working dames in space. It's a pretty much slice of life, wandering tale, following them from job to job. And you start getting hints. Like Barry, I like dropping things that I will go into deeper later. So
there's sort of a mashup quality about Dicebox. There's Griffin and Molly, the two mm-hmm. characters. They're itinerant laborers, but there's a bit of some gender play, not only with the main characters but also with the characters you meet on different planets. And not everything's shiny in the sort of old sci-fi sense. There's a lot of broken down technology. There's a lot of playing with culture and art along the way.
Oh yeah, well that's my basic
mythology.
Yeah, I definitely approach science fiction as more of a way to express ideas than say, and this is what we will do, and this is what society will be like. I'm taking the assumption, well, it's still going to be full of humans, and this is what's going to happen. Humans are cheap. Humans cheat, but they make great things, but they're also fanciful. Just because a tech is available doesn't mean it's popular. It doesn't catch on. Like, you know, computers took a long time to get into the mainstream. Just about anything that we take for granted. High-definition television was around since the 60s, but you have to wait for the infrastructure, so you're going to have a lot of spottiness.
You're listening to Words and Pictures on KABU. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And my guests this morning live in the studio are Jen Manley Lee, creator of Dicebox, and Barry Deutsch, author of Hirville. Their graphic novels started out as webcomics but are now on the bookshelves in fabulous hardcover editions. Jen, talking about Dicebox, I have to tell you, I'll be a little confessional here, that people kept telling me for ages to go and check out Dicebox on the web. And and by the way, the book that's out now is largely, it's not a Kickstarter campaign, but it's something you worked out through your own website, crowdsourced mm-hmm. the financing for among your friends and supporters and fans.
Yes, that's true. This is before the really big Kickstarters, and this is a full-color book. It's 315 pages and available at the Multnomah County Library, as well as for sale at my website. I'm very proud of the fact that it's available at the library. And I was a little embarrassed about how much it cost. because it's a color print run and I wanted to do a couple thousand. I still made it with my my private sourcing without revealing my goals or anything. But now it seems paltry considering the amount of money that's gone to publishing comics on Kickstarter.
Yeah, the size of this book, if you haven't seen it, it's significantly larger than the average graphic novel. It's, what, 350 pages?
315.
Wow. And this is only part one of a four-part series.
Part one, but I should also mention that book one contains all the fill-in stories that people did for me.
Ah.
When, you know, back when I was on a pay site, and if people were paying, they should have content. And back, you know, when it was more expected. So I would say that the story of Dicebox itself is 260, and the rest is extras, like the fill-ins, which Barry did one.
Yay.
He Barry did the first one, in fact. And art and whatnot.
Well, I have to confess that people were telling me for ages to go, and I had the hardest time getting into it. I was just, one of the reasons was, is that so much backstory to the characters and to the cultures and to the planets and to the technology are there before even the first panel. It's almost Tolkien-esque how much backstory there is. So I just had to leap in and just start going through it literally and not stopping too much, because you do have just entirely crafted worlds that you obviously had worked out long before you started the comic.
Yes and no. I mostly, because I don't think in worlds, I think in people and cultures and social groups, and that I had more worked out. And my intention always, and a lot of people eventually get this, I don't expect you to keep track of everybody that they're talking about. This is the backstory. Wanda really is the backstory to the other three books. And people start recognizing names because they come up again, or concepts because they come up again. I don't expect an instant recognition. I wanted it to feel like you're just jumping into the life process. I didn't want to do an introduction. I did, obviously, but I didn't want to do like, and here's this character and this is their situation. I wanted it to evolve.
And what's also interesting is that I noticed that a lot of the big action parts actually sort of take place off screen. So it's really just a really intimate lens almost from the points of view of Griffin and Molly.
That was intentional. I wanted things that you could reasonably overhear. I didn't want like a, you know, big, you know, God's eye view, though sometimes with establishing shots I use that. I wanted it to be about them. There'll be lots of action later, but everybody knows what a spaceship crash looks like. Honestly, at this point, I'm not showing you anything new. It's already 260 pages. Something had to go.
So tell us, okay, Dicebox, I remember that you said that you had these characters and these ideas kicking around, and the title is what really got you going. And Dicebox is a reference to the Peorth rune in Anglo-Saxon mythic literature, and it symbolizes a number of things, something revealed that had been hidden, maybe a game piece or a pawn, maybe the womb. And I guess you were inspired also by another Nordic rune, Jira, the turning wheel.
Yes. It's like everything is a cycle, and there's fate, but there's also randomness. That's why I like the whole kind of dice metaphors. You take these items, you throw them in, you shake them up, and you throw them out, and let's see what happens.
You're the godlike narrator?
Yes, I am.
So what's next? I know you're partway through the next volume, Chase, which is, you've already got it mapped out. Tour of Duty and Quest are going to be the
correct
final ones.
Correct. Well, Chase is some of the payoff of what I was hinting during Wander with like Griffin's past, and you start if I had to say each, what is each four books about? Okay. Wander, book one is asking the question, who are Griffin and Molly? Book two is saying, what were their pasts? Book three will be, what is their present? Book four will be, what is their future? So book two, there's a lot of featured memories of Griffin and Molly, kind of like revealing things that have gone before, which may or may not be talked about.
Almost a cinematic flashback then?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, but you know, I'm not, yes, but it's from... it's from, what is that, first person? First person, it's from how they saw it and what they saw.
Oh, so it's filtered through their lens.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. And there's a lot of comeuppance of what Griffin did before in book two, and there'll be more about Molly's past as we get on, and there'll be a resolution and then a moving forward.
Yeah, this is what I see in both of your books, in Dicebox and in Hereville, is that the characters, and you know, both female protagonists, a lot of the action and excitement comes from their mistakes, their bad judgment, but also a lot of the progression of the story and the progression of the world around them. I mean, it's almost like the Garden of Eden story. You know, Adam and Eve mess up, but they get kicked out of the garden to this big wider world.
Mm-hmm. I like that analogy, but I like it. You're getting to know these people. You don't know everything about them. You're going to get to know them like you get to know any friend or situation, or if you start in the middle of a TV series, or well, you'll catch up. It'll all become clear.
Well, you've been noticed, certainly Friends of Lulu. They gave you the Kimberly Yale Award for Best New Talent.
They nominated me.
Oh, they nominated you.
That year, Raina Telgemeier actually won.
And you got nominated for an IGNITS and mm-hmm. shortlisted for Tiptree, which is sci-fi, right?
Yeah, well, not shortlisted. Okay. I'm on the list of nominations. Okay. So I'm being considered for the Tiptree.
So are you getting sci-fi fans as well as comics fans?
I always have gotten sci-fi fans.
Okay.
So I've had a lot of people saying you should come at this or that sci-fi reader con, basically. So.
Well, I see that the Oregonian called Dicebox the gravitational center of Oregon's vibrant web comic scene.
Yeah. I'm not sure about that, but it was very sweet. I did help transplant quite a few cartoonists in my day, me and my husband. We had a spare room, and so we let them, you know, when they were moving to Portland, it's like, stay in the spare room. So
that's right. You had a house that you no longer live in mm-hmm. That used to be sort of the center of planning for the Stumptown Comics Fest in its early days.
That's right. Well, probably the mid-phase, I would say, at this point. Yeah. First part took place totally in Indigo Kelly's living room. It happened like the middle phase. I don't know where they have their meetings now. But it also hosted Salon Bidet. That was a Dylan McConis production because she used to rent the flat downstairs from us. And she used to host a bunch of cartoonists for Portland just to come and hang out and share stuff about once a week.
Yeah, probably 90% of all the cartoonists I've met in Portland, I met at Dylan's salons.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the Stumptown Comic Fest, of course, is a creator-centric
yes.
con. So you don't have, say, Sony Pictures or Warner Brothers coming in and setting up. It really is all Artist's Alley at the Comic Fest. Well, let me talk again about the books. This is the Barry Deutsch is the author of Hereville. The second book is on the shelves now, How Mirka Met a Meteorite. And Jen Manley Lee is the creator of Dicebox. These graphic novels started out as web comics, but are now on the bookshelves in fabulous hardcover editions. Jen and Barry, tell us how to find out more, how listeners can find out more about your work.
You can find all my work at dicebox.net.
And you can find Hereville at hereville.com.
That's H-E-R-E-V-I-L-L-E. That's great. Thanks for listening to us, to all our listeners. Thanks for listening at 90.7 FM and on the web. You've been listening to Words and Pictures on KABU. I'm your host, S.W. Kountzer. And this show will be available later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your community radio station.
And you're tuned to Community Radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM, Hood River and the Gorge, 100.7 FM, Corvallis and Albany. And we are at K220HR, Hood River, and K264AA, Corvallis.